All right, the next case this morning will be 25-1113, Garrison Property and Casualty v. Horton. Counsel for appellant, I understand you're going to try to split your time, is that right?
We're going to attempt it.
Okay. If you'll make the first counsel for appellant, if you'll make your appearance and proceed, please.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michelle Cortez, and I represent appellate Nicholas Horton. Let me explain the injustice that occurred in this case, which we asked this court to remedy. The district court rewarded USA and Garrison for their egregious conduct when it granted them summary judgment, finding no conflict between exclusion B1 and the non-owned vehicle exceptions. That was error. For this contention, the district court claimed the non-owned vehicle exceptions only pertain to ownership and use. But that's not true. There's five factors under the non-owned vehicle exceptions. Ownership, use, family member, that it be primarily insured by another carrier, and most importantly here, and what the district court ignored, is that it be a vehicle. Now that term vehicle was chosen by USA and Garrison, and it's a very broad term. They also chose not to define vehicle, even though they could have. So when we give effect to the term vehicle, as the district court should have done, that shows the conflict in the policy. So what is the conflict? Exclusion B1 avoids coverage for a vehicle, which all parties agree is a motorcycle, includes a motorcycle. So exclusion B1 avoids coverage for a motorcycle not listed on the declarations. But the non-owned vehicle exceptions restore coverage for a non-owned motorcycle not listed on the declarations. Those provisions conflict, meaning they're internally inconsistent. And under established, long-standing Colorado law under Simon, Neeson, Collard and Worsham, the conflicting exclusion must fall and the policy must be construed in favor of coverage for the insured here, Horton. This is supported by USA and Garrison's own interpretations of coverage. They had an adjuster who said, we are affording coverage. They had in-house counsel that said that there is coverage under the non-owned vehicle exceptions. They even certified to the Colorado Insurance Commissioner that they were expanding their policy to provide non-owned vehicle coverage. That is their own term, non-owned vehicle coverage. So this is consistent with Neeson versus State Farm, in which the court supported its finding of coverage by State Farm's own interpretation, finding coverage for the other victims of the crash.
They, in Simon, however, were not the provisions that led the court to believe, the Colorado Supreme Court to believe that there was a basis for confusion. They both related to warranties, right?
Sort of, Your Honor, but it wasn't that clear when you look at it on its face. So there was an exception restoring coverage for warranties. Then there was an exclusion for what's called completed operations. When you look at that on its face, you may not think those provisions conflict. It wasn't until completed operations was defined, which is defined as in part warranties, then you see the conflict between warranties.
And the I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Would you agree in that case the court found that that was a conflict that was irreconcilable?
Correct.
Now, in this case, is it your position that the issues here, the conflict that you're raising, is irreconcilable, meaning that the various exclusions and the exceptions, there's no way to read those in such a way that there's not a conflict?
Correct, Your Honor, because they both...
Why wouldn't they, with regard to exclusion B1, why wouldn't they put the same language in the exception to B2? And why does it say, on the exception to B2, why does it specifically say, with regard to exclusion B1? And the same with B3. It says the exception with regard to exclusion B3. I mean, it says that specific language in those paragraphs, right?
But let me make sure I understand the question. That the exception to B2 says this exclusion does not apply in the B2 language. The only thing I can understand about that is that these exclusions and exceptions were added to the policy at different times, and so there's different language. But there's nothing in the policy that says that B1 controls B2.
But you're trying to apply an exception which is set forth in B2. You're trying to apply that to B1, right?
Incorrect, Your Honor. Okay. That is a red herring that USA and Garrison have raised. Those are just exceptions under B2 and B3. The issue is, do they conflict with B1? Because the policy language does not say B1 and B2 and B3 have to be met. There's no word and between them. Adding that word...
Right, but there's no and for the exclusions either. You have one exclusion, you're excluded, right?
Correct, but under Colorado law, if they conflict, and this is something that is unique to Colorado law, it is a cornerstone principle of insurance law in Colorado. If they conflict, the one doesn't still control. The conflicting exclusion falls. So in this case, because the exceptions to B2 and B3 restore coverage, and because they conflict with exclusion B1, B1 falls and does not control, and coverage must be construed in favor of the insured Horton.
But if the exceptions to B2 and B3 apply to B2 and B3, what is the predicate for the conflicting basis? I mean, what's the conflicting basis? If they apply to their provisions, I think that's what Judge Heil was talking about.
The problem with the district court, the problem that I think the district court had was that it was an overgeneralization of what the exclusions were about, but it was not a full analysis of all the factors.
Well, let me ask you this. Under exclusion B1, do you agree that a motorcycle is excluded from coverage?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so the issue is how do the exceptions in B2 and B3 change that?
If it wasn't on the deck sheet, it was excluded from coverage. And that is a key provision. Now, B2 and B3, which were added later, which make the policy internally inconsistent, restore coverage for a non-owned motorcycle, not just a motorcycle, a non-owned motorcycle that's not on the deck sheet. So because the non-owned motorcycle is restored that's not on the deck sheet, that conflicts.
And that's the point I was trying to get at earlier. It seems to me that Simon was dealing with apples and apples. Here you're not dealing with apples and apples. B2 goes to, the distinction B2 draws is on ownership. The distinction B1 draws is on the nature of the vehicle. And therefore, whereas in Simon, they were both dealing with warranties. So one could read into that a potential for confusion. Here, you've got B2 and 3 talking about the basis of the vehicle ownership, B1 talking about the nature of the vehicle. Why would there be any basis for conflicting understanding of those?
Your Honor, let me answer this question, then I probably need to sit down. So the term that is the key here is the term vehicle. There is no restriction on the number of wheels of that vehicle under B2 and B3. Now, they could have said, we restore coverage for non-owned cars, or they could have said, we restore coverage for non-owned autos and define that as a four-wheel car. They specifically chose non-owned vehicles and certified vehicles to the Colorado Insurance Commissioner.
So you're saying the basis for conflict exists in the fact that B1 talks about vehicles and the word vehicle appears in B2 and B3?
And the issue of it not needing to be on the deck sheet, Your Honor.
Is there any issue with regard to how does reliance play into this?
How does reliance play into
this? Was there any reliance on that conflict?
Your Honor, I think that the conflicting interpretations of USA and Garrison over many years show that they did not know how their provisions operated together. And I understand that Ms. Abeda relied on USA and Garrison's representations when she filed suit against Horton regarding coverage.
But the record is pretty clear that Mr. Horton didn't rely on that.
Mr. Horton relied on USA and Garrison being upfront with him and treating him as a quasi-fiduciary, which they did not when they didn't raise coverage timely. For 5 years, USA and Garrison didn't raise coverage, and that is prejudice as a matter of law. And I apologize for stuttering. I'm just worried about the time. If I could pass it over. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Michael Rosenberg here on behalf of Teixeira Ebeda. March 13th will be the eighth anniversary of this horrible motorcycle crash. I did want to acknowledge in the front row that Teixeira's mother and sister both came so they could be here to watch these proceedings today. Our issue, real quickly, I think it's laid out in the briefs. We do believe that the policy is at best ambiguous, which is reflected by the fact that USAA's own legal department concluded there was coverage. They offered the $100,000 unconditionally when we got into the case. We got into the case, you know, a year, year and a half after those settlement opportunities were already gone. And so the idea that you could not raise an exclusion until 3.5 years after the accident and one that you didn't raise before, you know, is just contrary to every Colorado case there is. And the Lira case, I did want to say, is a completely different animal, because the Lira case, which says an insurance company doesn't have an obligation to consider punitive damages.
Counsel, could I just...
Sure.
Time is short, so let's focus in a little on a question. Your brief indicates that the common law bad faith claim is based on the company's failure to settle, and then, of course, the resulting excess judgment. Is that an accurate statement of your argument?
Well, I don't believe that encompasses all of our argument. The investigation and the lack of one.
Where did you talk about that?
It's talked about throughout all of the briefs.
Where in your brief did you say that?
Because most
everything in your brief is about the settlement.
We talked about the investigation, Your Honor, and I do want to give the time back to Ms. Cortez.
Well, this is the question that I think we need to have.
It's in the brief. He did not investigate the question of ownership, Your Honor. He didn't investigate it, and then when he was told it, this is Todd Ellis. He was told.
Okay, well, we can read the brief. If you can't pinpoint where it is, then we need to move on. The appellees say that you cite no authority that holds an insurer owes a duty to settle a non-covered claim. And I'm just quoting from their brief on that. Is that true?
No authority that a duty...
authority.
That's a red herring because...
You cite no authority that holds an insurer owes a duty to settle a non-covered claim.
I would agree with that. And it is a red herring that doesn't mean anything, Your Honor.
Well, if you have a non-covered claim... Then what happens to
insurance
your argument?
Companies settle claims every day without knowing
Counsel,
whether they're
you're not
be
listening.
Covered or
you're not.
Not
listening to the question. Assume the claim is non-covered. Is there a duty to settle? And do you have any authority for that?
If you can assume it's non-covered, which they could not do, so I reject.
I'm asking
that
you, counsel, you don't disagree with the question.
No, I just agree.
What
with
did you? Okay, what's the answer? Is there a duty to settle a non-covered claim under Colorado law?
If that claim is non-covered and that's been determined, or you properly and timely reserve your rights.
I want to understand the time frame. When does the duty attach in the context of the settlement situation? I mean, if the claim absolutely is not covered, that's one thing. But at the time that they rejected the offer to settle, if the knowledge they had did not indicate it was not covered. What is the implication of that for Colorado law?
What Colorado says by statute and from the Trimble case forward in every single case, including the Arellano versus Cruz case that I attached as supplemental authority in every single case, the question is, would a reasonable insurer act this way? And if not, did it cause damage?
Act this way when is what I'm saying. Does timing matter?
Timing's everything. Yes. When it comes to this, timing is absolutely everything. All That's right. why we have rules about raising affirmative coverage defenses within a reasonable time. It's to prevent this very case of what happened. I don't think anyone should be okay with what happened and excuse what happened here. And I think it's sad. Thank you.
All right. Cases, counsel, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, Jeremy Mosley on behalf of Appalese Garrison and USAA. This case is about two auto policies that plainly exclude coverage for a motorcycle. As you heard, it is undisputed that exclusion B1 in the policy excludes coverage for a motorcycle.
Clarify for me, Mr. Mosley, however, what this question that I was trying to tease out relative to the common law bad faith claim. At the time that Ms. Abeda sought to settle, at the time that those settlement conversations were going on, it's my understanding that the light of B1 had not shown itself in this case in terms of its ability to exclude coverage. So my question is, when do you judge this duty of common law bad faith? And to put a finer point on it, if at point A, discussions occur in which somebody says, I'm ready to settle, and it is unclear or it appears that there may be coverage, and the insurer denies it. Point B, a year down the road, the insurer knows that there is not coverage. When do you judge their common law bad faith?
Generally speaking, Colorado law says that you judge their conduct based on what was available at the time. But you still have to have a duty that arises. And if there's no covered claim, there's no duty to settle.
I'm talking about the duty now to act to settle. And what I'm saying is, do you measure the duty by what they knew at the time? That's what I understood you to say. And if that's true, what did you know at the time that this settlement was going on that would have allowed you to, in good faith, deny the settlement?
So a few things. First of all, there's a difference between whether a duty arises and if there is a duty, how that's measured. So that's why I say that the good faith, or how your conduct is measured based on what you knew at the time for the claim, but the duty doesn't arise if there was no coverage at all. So that's the distinction that matters first under Colorado law.
Does that mean it, no matter what the conduct at point A, as Judge Holmes said, and then later it's determined that there's no coverage, is that just retroactive? It wipes away any what would otherwise have been bad faith?
It depends on the damages alleged. There still have to be damages flowing from that alleged bad faith conduct.
Well, that there is a claim that there are damages, and Judge Heil stated it more elegantly than I could. That's the point. Does it retroactively, the fact that you later learn there's coverage, does it retroactively, let's assume that you acted in bad faith. I'm not making a judgment on that. Let's assume you acted in bad faith at point A, and we later find out there was not coverage at point B. Are you absolved from that bad faith at point A?
If the only damages alleged are a failure to settle and there was never a duty to settle, then there is no actionable conduct that can be tied to the damages being claimed.
Well, I think they're claiming damages.
But the only damages they're claiming is an alleged failure to settle. And there was never a duty to settle because there was never coverage.
No. The coverage issue I thought we were talking about as being discrete. the question of whether you ultimately had to settle. Okay, whether there was ultimately coverage. You're saying that in that moment in time, when that settlement conversation was going on, why could the argument not be that you acted unreasonably in that moment in time in not settling based upon what you knew at that time?
At the time, first of all, because you also asked this as well, what is the evidence? And volume 6, page 1045 in the record and around there, there are the letters that USAA sent and Garrison sent, saying from the outset that there was no coverage. And because there was no coverage, they would not pay the claim. They say that this motorcycle is not insured by USAA or Garrison. They said that in the letter.
When did those letters arise? I mean, is this after the lawyer communicated the information about B1? What are we talking about now?
We're talking about from the beginning, October of 2019, when Abeda's counsel first raised a claim. The response was to say, our position is there is no coverage.
Right, but why did they say there was no coverage at that time? It wasn't because of B1.
They did not cite specifically to B1.
It said B2 or B3, right?
They cited to, well, first of all, their initial was to talk about potential UIM coverage based on the other driver's liability. They also then said, even for liability coverage, it wouldn't be covered because it's not listed, it's not insured under these policies. And they subsequently cited to B2 and talked about ownership, which ultimately correctly applied to one policy, the USAA policy, and not to the Garrison policy.
Let me ask my same question with regard to Judge Mathis's question, because I ask it in the context of a duty to settle, so to speak. But let's just say that there's no reasonable investigation. It's just not done for whatever reason, or it was sloppy. And then later, years later, you find out that there's no coverage based upon an issue that was really never raised. Does that retroactively wipe away any problems with the failure to investigate?
It depends on the damages alleged.
Because the duty to investigate is a separate duty, right?
Yes, but it rises out of the contract.
What's your position on whether the claimant preserved a failure to investigate claim? Is that an issue here?
It's not, because what they've raised instead is focused on the duty to failure to settle. And here's the key. In the abstract,
Could I just jump in, because I've got a follow-up on that answer. Do you say anything about waiving that issue in your brief?
We argued instead what they focused on. Their brief focused on failure to settle, so we responded to that.
Yeah, but did you address the unreasonable investigation question in your brief?
What we've addressed, and this is what ties it all together, is the damages being alleged. It's not enough to just say I was damaged. You have to say, what are your damages? They did here. It's undisputed. Their only damages are the excess verdict that flows from a failure to settle. Here's what matters. Horton is the insured who the duty was owed to, if any duty was owed previously in the claims handling. Horton testified that if he had been consulted about those demands being made, he did not have the money to make that claim or to make that payment. He also testified he would have simply told Garrison or USAA that they should make the payment. What that turns back to is he's telling them that they should have made a payment for an uncovered claim.
I'm just asking you what you put in your brief. Okay. Did you argue against any claim for unreasonable investigation? Counsel says it's all over, that it's all preserved. And my question is, I think you just answered that you don't think it is, but did you waive the waiver by addressing it in your brief?
No, because what we addressed in our brief was what they raised, and that's what I'm trying to put together, is the focus entirely
right.
of their arguments
I think
is the failure to settle.
I think you've answered the question. Thank you.
And what I'm struggling to understand is why could not damages flow from the failure to settle? And if your answer is because there was no coverage, that seems a very incomplete answer. I mean, if the issue is that there was an excess judgment as a result of your failure to settle based upon the information you knew at the time, and let's just posit, assume that you were unreasonable in not settling at that point in time. And because you didn't settle at that point in time, what we ended up with was an excess judgment. Why couldn't damages flow from that excess judgment?
Because the duty to settle arises from indemnity. And if there is no coverage, there is no duty to settle. That's the principle that the Lira Court, the Colorado Supreme Court and Lira v. Shelter made very clear in distinguishing between compensatory damages in that case that were covered and punitive damages that were not covered. What the court said is this: if the insurer has no contractual duty to indemnify the insured for punitive damages, the insurer has no tort duty to settle in good faith with regard to those damages.
Is this answer to Chief Judge Holmes, in effect, saying it didn't matter what they knew about coverage during this settlement, this key settlement period? All that matters is whether there, in fact, was coverage?
On the issue for a duty to settle, correct. It doesn't matter what was known then, because you have to have the duty that arises before you apply the test of whether there's bad faith. The duty does not arise on a claim to settle that claim when it's a non-covered claim. And what was known at the time was that it was a motorcycle. Ownership was initially questioned.
So this may be a hypothetical, but let's say during the settlement period, the company thought there was coverage, even though under the policy maybe there wasn't. Let's assume there wasn't. Once you look at the policy and study it, and we can argue the exclusion, the exceptions, and all that. But let's say that at the time they thought there was coverage and then didn't settle, and then we have the excess judgment. Are you saying that doesn't matter? What really matters is just whether there was coverage?
When we're talking about a duty to settle, that is correct. What matters is whether there's coverage. That's what Lira says. No duty to settle arises for uncovered damages.
Is your answer the same with regard to the duty to investigate, though? Is your answer the same? If there's no coverage, then that retroactively wipes away any breach of a duty to investigate?
It depends on what damages are then alleged. And that's why I referred to what Horton actually said.
So your answer is different on that. But it's still, you still have to show damages. But your answer is, if there's no coverage at the end, that doesn't wipe away your obligation to investigate reasonably. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
But you then have to show what actual damages are tied to that.
So what would be recoverable damages, and why weren't there recoverable damages here?
Well, for example, when you have a non-covered claim, this is why Horton's testimony matters. It's one thing if Horton said, had I known about that offer at the time to which you were saying there was no coverage, I would have paid that claim. I would have entered that settlement. There are other courts and other states that apply that standard.
There's no coverage early on because they investigate it, and they show that there's no coverage. The case probably doesn't even go to trial, right?
Well, not true, because they actually did investigate it. They said there was no coverage, and they kept coming back.
I mean, no coverage on exclusion B1.
Well, but that's, I mean, we're hearing today that that's not even true, because the other sections provide coverage. They were sent a copy of the policy in the middle of this, the liability section of the policy, and they still proceeded.
Counsel,
with making this claim,
internal documents in the record where adjusters or counsel or whatever says there was coverage. What do we do with that?
Well, I mean, first of all, that's evidence that isn't relative to what their actual damages being claimed are, that tie back to the fact that there had to be a duty to settle for us to pay benefits first. The second thing is those specific documents were asking a single question. Does B2 apply? They weren't even addressing B1 in those documents. There are other documents that address B1 where the adjuster went and got a coverage opinion, and then after asking about B1, issued the reservation of rights letter. So they're being overread to claim that that meant there was coverage under the policy.
Asking about B1, I thought that that B1 surfaced because the lawyer told them about B1.
No, I mean
Wheeler Trigg, that lawyer.
Oh, No, no. Actually, the timing of that is incorrect. They had previously, before Wheeler Trigg was involved, already started, had already requested a coverage opinion from a different law firm, Sweetbaum & Sands. So while that's what Abeta claims in the record, that's not what's supported by the facts. Page, volume 12, page 1806, you'll see Wendy Boyd testifies that earlier in August, they were already requesting this coverage opinion, completely separate from Wheeler Trigg, because Wheeler Trigg's on defense and they weren't looking to them for coverage at all. They were looking to a coverage.
Yeah, but was the first information you received about B1 from Wheeler Trigg?
No, it was not.
Let me ask you a question that.
And it can't have been.
And
because of that
I understand this is a difficult question. But what is your position or your client's position on whether or not the claim was initially properly and reasonably investigated? What is your position on that?
That it was properly and reasonably investigated and determined there was no coverage, and that held up that there was no coverage. And Colorado law is also clear.
What's your position on
whether
the claim was properly investigated and timely investigated with regard to the reason there was no coverage, meaning ultimately B1? What's your position on that?
From the outset, the letter said it was not covered as a result of not being insured under the policy and not being listed on the policy. And that is part of what B1 says too. I believe that there was sufficient information presented from the beginning as to what the ultimate coverage exclusion used that applies is. And because Colorado law is clear that you can't create coverage by estoppel, that same idea still applies, that just because you mention one exclusion and don't mention all the others that could also apply doesn't mean you can't raise them later, and it doesn't mean you acted in bad faith by doing that either.
Well, didn't things go off track because there was a mistaken understanding that Nicholas owned the motorcycle and not the dad?
That was one thing that he was relying on the adjuster and focusing on that exclusion when ultimately it applies to one policy and not the other.
Well, why isn't that relevant to whether the investigation was reasonable?
Because the only damages that have been alleged as a result of that are to say we should have gone ahead and paid a claim that was not covered. It's not tied to any other conduct and damages. That's the fundamental problem that the district court recognized, and that's why it should be affirmed. Thank you.
30 seconds.
Your Honor, there was an issue about the Wheeler Trigg opinion, and that goes back to the reliance question. There was reliance from Mr. Horton because he relied on retained defense counsel to act in his best interests when they went behind his back and issued this coverage opinion adverse
to his
interests.
He said he wouldn't have done anything differently, though, didn't he?
Your Honor.
What would he have done differently?
He had no right to handle the claim. If he would have been able to handle the claim, maybe he would have been able to do something differently. But he had no right to handle the claim, and so that's boxing him in on a legal argument. He couldn't pursue that avenue. And one last thing.
I thought you were going to answer the question, do your damages stem from anything other than a failure to settle?
Your Honor, our damages stem from the unreasonable conduct, the excess judgment, which is prejudice as
which
a matter of law.
Which relates to the failure to settle,
And it relates to emotional distress, having to go through the underlying trial. Emotional distress from the deck action. The reason why we're in this deck action is because Wheeler Trigg issued that opinion adverse to his interests. And the last point is, there was a letter that USA and Garrison sent to Horton right after he was sued, affirming coverage under the policy, which he did rely on, that there was coverage.
All right. Chief, may I ask another question?
Sure, of course.
I'm going to ask you the same question I ask opposing counsel. So basically I said, well, if they would have asserted B1 initially, maybe the case doesn't go to trial. But your position sounds like it would have went to trial anyway if they didn't settle, because you would have taken the position that you're taking now, that there was coverage under the exception to exclusions B2 and 3, right?
And let me make sure I understand the question. If they would have properly raised B1, would have it gone to trial?
Well, would you have said, wait a minute, there's no coverage? I mean, the case goes away, essentially.
Well, I think Horton would have informed Abeta, the insurance companies are saying there's no coverage.
Well, that's what they were saying. But what would the position on the other side have been? Well, there's still coverage under B2 and B3?
I think it raises reasonable coverage dispute, and then there's a question from Abeta whether to even pursue the claim, because this accident happened in 2018. Mr. Horton has been fighting this since 2018, and it's taken years of his life. And there needs to be an analysis, and there is an analysis by plaintiff's attorneys, would this be reasonable to pursue this? And in this case, we've been told they wouldn't have pursued it because it would have been a protracted fight. But since they denied it on a false basis, Abeta thought, oh, there's definitely coverage. We're going to file suit against Horton, and Horton got roped into this. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well, and I know there's some family members here, and I know this is all hard to hear, and I know it's a terrible tragedy under any circumstances, but I'm sorry for your loss. We're looking at this on legal issues, and that doesn't impact your loss either way. I understand that, so let me just say that.
Okay, thank you.
Case is submitted. Thank you, counsel. And we'll take our 10-minute break now.